On today's show, we talk about the silent and unseen pandemic, where those suffering do so behind closed doors and can't be so easily counted. This is Penhold Talk Radio. And welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us. I am Brian Constantine. I am here with my co-host, Michael Rowland.
Hello, hello.
So as you've driven past the multiplex this month, you've probably noticed that it's lit up in purple at night. And this is to bring awareness to the fact that November is Family Violence Prevention Month. And this is really a topic that is often kept quiet. It's one that's difficult to discuss. And really, I think it can be classified as a silent pandemic. Just a couple quick stats here, just kind of get you aware of the situation. It's now estimated that 1 in 5 domestic violence instances go unreported. So when you consider, when you look at numbers about of how prevalent domestic violence is, consider those are severely underreported to what actually happens. And then from 2008 to 2019, there have been 204 deaths in Alberta, just Alberta, due to domestic and family violence. And certainly the stress and the proximity caused by COVID restrictions has not increased or has not helped the situation.
Yeah, that just amplifies everything.
Yeah, you just put everyone in very stressful, very close proximity to one another. And so to discuss this, it's not going to be just Michael and I. We are certainly not the experts in this. We have indeed brought in an expert to help us through this situation. So we are grateful to welcome our first guest to PTR, Penhold Talk Radio. Get the acronym in there. Yep. We're going to brand this PTR. Roy is the founder of Your Thriving Family and Masquerade Ministries, and he's been helping men, women, couples, families overcome and thrive for over 10 years now. And you can certainly go and find out more about him and the ministry and the services they provide at yourthrivingfamily.ca. And so we want to welcome my friend, Roy. Thank you for coming on the show. Thank you for making time for us this episode.
It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for the invite.
So let's start off at the very beginning. What is Your Thriving Family? Let's get to know what your ministry and services are all about.
Yeah. So first of all, I'd like to say that I am the co-founder, and I am the founder, but Tiffany couldn't be here tonight. She really wanted to be, but unfortunately our little 11-year-old was home, not feeling well. So she stayed home, and so I'll represent us.
Yeah, Tiffany, your wife.
My wife, yeah. Tiffany, yeah. So what is Your Thriving Family and Masquerade Ministries? You know, Your Thriving Family is just that. We promote thriving families through healthy relationships. So it's a service that helps people to discern what a healthy relationship is, because the absence of unhealthy doesn't make it healthy. And it brings it all with a biblical world view and perspective. And then the number one threat to families today is family violence. And so we are unique in all of family ministry, that we are just as able to be effective in family violence than we are as in the other forms of help that we provide. So we help people right from dating and premarital to marital investment. And then we help men become realizing the husbands and fathers and leaders that God created them to be. And really bringing that clarity to what does leadership look like as a husband and a father in the home today, with a 2021 world view, if biblical worldview. So how do we take those passages that we read that were written in some other place, in another language, in another culture, and place them right here in central Alberta in 2021? Yep. Yeah.
So Your Thriving Family doesn't just come in when there's problems or abuse or violence has already come in, you actually try to, if you will, preempt, or you provide services that would prevent that kind of.
Absolutely. So there's prevention and then there's intervention. Mm-hmm. When we in Alberta talk about Family Violence Prevention Month, we're really talking about Family Violence Intervention Month. We're trying to teach people how to intervene. So one of the questions you're likely to help ask me tonight is, if somebody's struggling, where do they get help? That's an intervention. But what we believe is that this is not going to get fixed until we start to handle it with a preventative measure. When we promote the four essentials to a healthy relationship, it's impossible for domestic abuse or family violence, whatever word you want to, we call it domestic abuse, but family violence is what it's called here in Alberta. And it's impossible for that to grow in the wake of the core four elements to a healthy relationship. And if I could draw an example metaphor is Sean Sosa, our men's minister, was a volunteer firefighter for many, many years. And if we look at fire prevention versus firefighting, what has changed in firefighting in the last 100 years? You know, really nothing. We drive faster cars or vehicles. We don't use horse and buggy. But basically we smother the fire. We still use water and they still wear hard things on their heads. They have breathing apparatus. Nothing really has changed with fighting fires. Everything has changed in preventing fires. Education. I remember myself, my father getting, liquored up and falling asleep with a cigarette in his mouth when he was sleeping on the couch and almost killing us all. And it's not funny. I mean, but that doesn't happen as much these days. Building materials right now, if a fire started, all your equipment will be ruined because there's fire suppression in all the public. Right. And so Sean looked at that from there was a great fire in Chicago many years ago. And that was the beginning of looking at things like fire prevention. Until we start to look at fire prevention in domestic abuse, which is prevention of it, we are going to be completely and utterly overrun by family violence. It is never going to get any better. It's and I would say there's an argument to say it's even going to get worse. Until we start to say what prevents it, the organizations that we have today to intervene are overrun. The women's shelter that is kitty corner to our offices here in central Alberta, a statistic before COVID, 500 women and almost 500 children would be turned away every single year from that shelter.
Just out of space requirements?
Because of space.
And resources. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's absolutely, mortifying when I would have to call. And I wouldn't have to call, but it's one of the things I do. It's very hard for a lady in that situation. And so I would call the shelter and see if there's room and for them to say she can come, but she's got to leave her daughter behind.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a reality because they're overrun. They're doing good work and they're working hard, but it's much like taking a pitchfork and going out. You guys might not.
You guys might not. You can't talk about grass fires.
Well, no, I'm related to. I'm a maritimer by heart. I was born and raised in Halifax. So, but we would say, my father would say, it's like taking a pitchfork and trying to stop the tide from rolling in, right? and that's literally the way it is right now. It is so overwhelming, and that is in what we call criminal domestic violence. When you made that statistic that only one in five
I go unreported. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's criminal domestic abuse. You can't call 911 when someone's using money and controlling you with it, or when they're verbally abusing you, or when they're isolating you. Those things are not criminal offenses. So when you start to put those statistics in, it is absolutely mind blowing. And what's really, really concerning is that the church does not have any better numbers than that we see in the general population. And in fact, it's harder for a man who is struggling with, gets charged with violence. It's harder for him. His stats are actually much, much lower than in the secular world in recovery. So his chances are very, very low in getting help. And now I think that there's reasons for that. And I think that, that we're addressing that, but it's definitely something that you know, as was said to me many years ago, that, you know, Jesus Christ is not being effective in this part of domestic violence is not affected by the church. It's we're behind on the times on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, you mentioned that the stat that 1 in 5 go unreported refers to kind of criminal violence.
Yeah.
And I think that helps segue into kind of defining what we were talking about.
Yeah.
So when it comes to family violence, I think most people think about physical violence.
Absolutely.
That's kind of the starting point that I came from. And at least then it wasn't until I started talking to you that I started understanding that family violence or what's defined as family violence is a much broader topic. So when we are talking about domestic abuse or family violence, what kind of things should we be putting into that kind of category?
Yeah, I'd say two things. If we want to look at and understanding domestic abuse, we have to stop looking at the what and start looking at the why. The why is more important than the what. So it's why our motive in what we're doing will reveal better. So I can be just as abusive with a bouquet of roses as I can with a slap across the cheek. And so it's the motive behind what we're doing. And then the second thing is that this is not a marriage problem or a relationship problem. This is a power and control problem. So what we want to look for is, where is the advantage? Who has the advantage in a relationship? And how are they using that? Are they using that in a way that they get their entitlements looked after? Or are they using it in a way that they're responsible with it? And the other one is the motive. Is like, why am I doing what I'm doing? Because even if I take a gentleman, and we work with gentlemen who they are not in the court system, they recognize that they want more in their family, and they want to learn better beliefs about power and control and leadership. And so when I will sometimes talk about male and female, but that's in the context that's what I work, that's what we work with, that's our focus. Is I work with men who are hurting their loved ones and are taking responsibility. Yep. And then I work with ladies that are affected by domestic abuse. That's our corner of the domestic abuse world or the family violence world. So there is certainly other places, many other realms, you know, elderly abuse, child abuse. Yeah. However, we stay focused on those two things, and we have for 13 years and done rather well with it. So as we look at that kind of the men that are coming, it's them learning that it's not enough that, for instance, that they stop calling names or yelling or slapping or pushing. Because if I start to do something nice for Tiffany so that she doesn't leave me, it simply is abusive because I'm still controlling her.
So manipulation is really kind of a key concept, it sounds like.
And it's manipulation to somebody who can't respond. And so, So if I was to say that Tiffany and I are in a, you know, in a dispute, and Tiffany asked me to leave the room because she's overwhelmed, she's feeling flooded and she needs a break. Or Tiffany might say, Roy, I need you to sit down and listen to me. I need to be heard. You know, I can yell louder, stomp harder, you know, I'm bigger than her. I have that advantage. And so, you know, it's my responsibility, I believe, in the family that I am going to make sure that Tiffany's voice is always recognized. So if she asks me to leave, I'm going to respect that. If Tiffany is going to ask me to sit down and listen, I'm going to respect that. Why? Because 10 times out of 10, if I wanted to walk out of the room, she cannot stop me. If she wanted to leave the room, I could stop her. Right. And because I have that physical advantage. And so any time that I would use that and not respect her voice, I would be abusing my power.
And that kind of it maybe addresses one of these kind of popular misconceptions. And again, I think I'll use myself, is that, or my own kind of mental framework when I'm thinking about this, is that you know, I'm not an abuser because I don't hit my wife. I don't yell at my wife. You know, I don't confine her or something like that. But what you're saying is that it seems like we can start looking for signs or at least things that might be warning signs of a direction in a relationship.
Yeah.
Something as simple as manipulating or enforcing our power over a situation, especially when the female doesn't have, especially the physical control of a situation.
Yeah.
But it goes much further than just physical confrontation.
Absolutely.
There's a subtler starting point, I think, in a lot of these things that I think a lot of people overlook or miss. Mm-hmm.
I 100% the way it was said to me at one time was that we don't abuse people as much as we abuse power. If we look at it that way, for instance, if a police officer was to pull me over and say that I was speeding and I start to cuss him up and, you know, call him the things that some people call police officers, I don't believe that that's abusive. I believe that it's maltreatment. It's not nice for me to treat a police officer that way, but he's in complete control. He can do anything he wants to me. He could tow my car. He could ticket me. He is the one that has the responsibility of authority in that situation. And so that he was to say the same things to me, the same what's, yep, and started calling me names and putting me down, it would be an abuse of power and it would clearly be wrong. And so we have always in a relationship, especially an intimate relationship, and especially one that is a biblically based, which is our world, we need to look at where is the advantage and are we using that advantage to serve the other person or are we using it to serve ourselves? And we cannot pick and choose. This is not a smorgasbord. You know, I truly believe that this is a duty that not that you have to do or you need to do, but that as a man, we get to do. I'd also like to say that though I'm talking about, you know, that we do work with men, a significant amount of men who are not abusers, but yep, struggle with choosing to abuse. And we can talk a little bit about that distinction because it's a big distinction later. But generally speaking, most of the men that I work with and we minister to are not, their wives would not designate them as abusive. They would say that there's some relationship struggles. And so we don't typically do marriage counseling. We work with men working with men on how to be men. And so how to be a husband and father, I think is in the realm of husband and father, not with, it's like quarterbacks working with quarterbacks as opposed to working with the kickers. Yeah. And so we typically work with men in a 30-week program that is not about disempowerment, but empowerment in bringing equality to the relationship through the core four elements of an intimate relationship that must be there in order for it to thrive.
Did you have any questions at this point?
Well, I was just thinking, so you talk about prevention. What kind of early steps do you take prior to there being any kind of a situation? What is some of that early prevention that your thriving family would get involved in?
Yeah, I think the best place you see it is in dating and premarital. In those two realms that we deal with. And the idea really is of taking an inventory of where the advantages are and recognizing them and then giving a sense of responsibility to those instead of a sense of entitlement. You know, fairness doesn't come into it with Tiffany and I physically because Tiffany does not have that advantage. And just, you know, it only takes me to stomp around the house and slam some doors like once or twice. And that will linger because I don't have to do that anymore. That stays with her in that tension. Right. So I have, you know, helping men to take an inventory of the advantages that they have and recognizing them and then being able to use that in a responsible way so that they can always create equality. Tiffany stayed at home. In most typical marriages, certainly in the Christian world, most women will sacrifice their career at some level to be a mother. they are putting a terrible, terrible responsibility, a chance on their husbands. What if things don't work out in 10 or 15 years and all of a sudden the wife has no education, no career. She's held back on everything, you know, and then we see like, you know, we see that my career chugging right along and Tiffany giving up her career at the hospital so that she could, cause she wanted to stay at home. And so I have this, when it was time for Tiffany, that we made the decision together as a family, I own that decision just as much as she does in that I have a responsibility. So now the paycheck comes home. You know, it's not that she gets five times she gets to pick, five times I get to pick. That paycheck is as much hers as it is mine.
Right.
You know, and I think from the worldview, it doesn't come from me, it comes from God. And so for me to say, well, he sent it to me first, so I get to say. Now imagine that 100 times we make the decisions and 99 I go with Tiffany, right? We go and make the same decision. But that one time I say, no. Ultimately, I make the money, so I get the say. That says that the other 99 times really don't count, because she'll know that deep down inside, she doesn't have the say unless it's the same say as I would say.
Yeah.
I don't know, you only get to say because you've declared it.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it's recognizing that so that we can create true equality through equity. Like there's this idea of that no matter how much power I have to give to Tiffany for us to be equals, we will do, you know, we're able to do that. And, you know, and we talk about, you know, a lot in Your Thriving Family about the ideas that are in scripture about a husband and a wife in leadership and words that like submission and headship. And there is a lot there that's said, but you know, the pulpit is, I'm just being frank, but the pulpit is not being straight enough about how does that play out. And so if we walk into a marriage with an I say you do idea of leadership, if we have that I say you do model of leadership, there is going to be a lot of troubles, because that is going to be misconstrued in a terribly powerful way. And you know, so it's this understanding of how do we prepare to prevent domestic abuse by promoting what it is for a family to grow in four things. That I always promote safety in my marriage, in my words, in my actions, and in my spiritual positioning. The opposite of that is intimidation. So I talked about it. I can be safe, like I can in the absence of intimidation, but if I've intimidated, you know, when I've gotten angry, if I yelled, and there's the possibility of that happening again, that intimidates Tiffany. See, and I can walk around for 6 months and think we're safe because I say we're safe.
Yeah. So I think that's an important point. Yeah. Just to hit on, it only takes that kind of one time of intimidation, as you say it. And I think, and maybe this, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but the man may think that, you know, 6 months down the road, we're in a good spot. You know, things are going well,
yeah.
But she's got a completely different mindset about the relationship.
Absolutely. And this is what we call the cycle of abuse or the cycle of violence, where there is a honeymoon phase, then detention phase, and an explosion phase. And then we go back in the honeymoon phase. And they don't typically use this now in women's shelters. When I went down to Duluth, Minnesota and got certified to work with men, you know, they talked about that this is not an effective model anymore, that the women do not relate to it because the honeymoon phase disappears if there's a cycle of abuse and they're just in a constant tension phase. And I said, true, but I'm working with men to understand their behaviors, and men have a honeymoon phase because they get to have it. They're in control. And so for them to understand that once survival mode kicks in for a lady, she's in a constant state of tension in that relationship. And again, I'm talking from a typical model of husband on his wife model of power and control being used. So that's our focus. That's what we focus in on. And so when I use gender references like man and female, I'm using that because those are the people that I minister to in those roles. We're dealing here not with a gender problem, but we are dealing with a power and control one. And so it's that so much of the world still, the men still have advantage. And we still do. And, but we, you know, we don't necessarily inventory that, I think, as much. And so the ladies that I minister to, I hear so frequently, it's not even that, say he pushed her against the wall or he put her down. Can Tiffany put me down? Yes. But it's that she can't do anything about it because I am physically dominant, bigger than her. And so it's that intimidation. And, yeah. And, you know, go look in a marriage book, go look and, you know, pick out, the love languages or love and respect or all of these books that have been written trying to help marriages. We've got 54% divorce rate in the church, 18% of marriages in the church are happily married. It's an epidemic just in misery, just in divorce and like we don't, before we even get into that, the idea of power and control misused, 80% of divorces in the church, 80% are initiated by one gender. It's like, it's glaring that behind closed doors, we have a massive problem that we are pouring massive, massive resources into, and it's massively not working. And never do we ever hear of the concept of, have we got safety in this room with these two people? Is there intimidation here or is there safety? Because if you don't have safety with your wife, you can't order pizza together. And I would say that, you know, I have had too many times, I have had ladies come in to meet with me and interrupt me right here as I go on the floor. And they would say to me that if they could just have that, you know, we're not talking about any physical acts of force being used against them whatsoever, no swear words being used at them, just general, you know, general issues. And they would say, if I could just feel safe with my husband, we could call it a day. All the rest of the other ones where you can keep. So often it's like a light bulb goes off. I say to the guys, if we could work 30 weeks on just establishing safety in our marriages, 30 weeks not wasted.
I'm just curious on that. How many men come in and is this safety intimidation thing, is this a light bulb moment for them as well in the same way or
no?
How does that work?
No, I think that the reason for that, I think that when it does is if they have themselves been traumatized as a child and then they, but you know, and if I may, and actually we said we weren't going to bring this up, but we're going to bring it up. If I may, it's pro wrestling. So I came out here to Alberta many years ago, 30 years ago, following my dreams of being a pro wrestler. And, there was a guy named Rick Titan here in Calgary and he became the second Razor Ramon in the WWF. But I remember the first time he body slammed me and he was darn near 7 feet tall and he body slammed me and I went to get up to do, and you know, wrestling's a gag, right? So Roy wasn't really hurt, but the wind was knocked right out of me. And he went to, he goes, what, did I knock the wind out of you? And I said, no, I just need a minute to get my breath. Cause he was almost 7 feet tall and I'd never been manhandled like that. Like he picked me up like a baby, yeah. You know? And so women, you know, we don't do that. Like we don't have that, you know, our wives, when we make love to them, we are pinning them down and dominating them, but we don't ever think about things like that because our wives are typically not bigger than us. We're seeing like in mixed martial arts where men are now fighting women.
Yep. Yep.
And they're the same exact weight, but yet their strength is so much more. Mm-hmm. They're cracking skulls, like literally breaking the lady's skull because we are physically more dominant.
Yep.
And so in most cases, and so women have a vastly different understanding of what it's like for someone to be bigger than them. And this was really brought to me in Duluth, Minnesota, where they invented male intervention. They and they patented, and Carol, the lady that had been doing it since 1982, and she talked to me about that. She said, Roy, you don't know what it's like. I walk around and I'm smaller than, you know, I'm smaller than all the men that I'm around constantly. And if you, so men typically where I see them feeling intimidation is when they're going to hold account for their actions. So say, say I come home late tonight and I didn't bring, you know, Tiffany asked me to bring something home and I forget to do it. That I will register as not feeling safe because she might feel mad at me, but I don't have that physical threat like Tiffany. Yeah. I just don't. just to get an idea of just in physical danger, if we can, if we looked at the stats in the Afghan war, we lost 101 soldiers in the war, 101 soldiers in Afghanistan. In that same period, we lost five times that many women to their spouses.
Yeah.
and that's not
counting. That doesn't show up in the headlines.
Yeah. And that's not counting, you know, that's the ones that paid with the ultimate price, but that's not counting the wounds we cannot see. Mm-hmm. This is a big, big issue, and it's not even measured. We don't even measure it properly. And so, yeah, ladies, you know, feeling intimidated is something not talked about often. The psychological model of like counseling does not address it. And until it's corrected, nothing can be established. I will not bring a couple into the room until I know that safety is established, because nothing will get done but make it worse. The second one is respect. And respect is to value as an individual, that they have their own, looks at and views of the world, their own opinions, their own tastes, and that we don't have a right to comment on that. That's not for us to be able, you know, to give the peanut gallery. If she wants to know my opinion, she can ask. But I'm actually supposed to protect her, the value of Tiffany, not to demote it. And so if Tiffany, you know, so the opposite of that is emotional abuse. So if Tiffany says, I'm upset now, and I say, well, you shouldn't feel that way. Or if she says, I think this, and I go, well, you shouldn't think that, or you didn't understand this. Those are all subtle forms of control. And when we control somebody, we're abusing our power. It's the opposite that I'm going to do. I'm going to respect Tiffany by valuing her opinion. When she says, I'm mad at you, I'm concerned that she's upset, right? The natural response to somebody when their wife is upset, a man should be concerned for that and want to understand where she's, like, her heart, not to say, hey, give me a second. I'm going to defend myself. So that's the second one, is that understanding, respect.
Yeah, so when you say it's not for the man to comment on the woman's, or is it just so that it's clear? Is it it's not like the men and women or husband and wife couldn't have discussions about what they believe. It's going beyond that, or even it's not like the man can't even have an opinion about what his wife believes. Yeah. I think what you're going with on this one here, it sounds like it's more kind of a dismissive attitude or kind of an approach to, say my wife's, feelings, as in, you're wrong to have those kind of feelings, it doesn't make sense, or there's no reason to be feeling that way.
Yeah. It's the entitlement to add in my two cents, whether it's welcome or not.
It's that I guess it kind of builds on the fix it mentality that men often have. It's kind of a perversion of that, if you will.
As long as she feels that her voice is not being squashed. Mm-hmm. And if I may, I brought an illustration. You know, when I meet ladies the first time, I use a cassette tape. Well, most of you probably don't know what this is.
Not that young.
But when I was a kid, you know, as a young guy, and if you need to, I want you to go, you can, probably on YouTube or whatever, rent The Wedding Singer. They actually make a mixtape. So I don't have any mixtapes. I just buy at the flea market. We buy these ones here. But in this cassette tape, you can imagine that this is Tiffany when I met her. And Tiffany had six songs on one side and six songs on the other. And those were her songs. And when I meet Tiffany, the question is, am I going to cherish that music? Because those songs are her songs. Those are her, that's who she is. Or do I get it right to put some of my songs on there? Because there's only enough room for six songs on each side. And if I'm going to start to add my songs in there, the first thing I need to do is erase some of hers. And so the ultimate lowest common denominator of domestic abuse is that we either assassinate a lady's character or we simply have an identity theft. And so when I talk about giving an opinion, that's an awesome context, because it's like, it's the idea that we're trying to erase her opinion so that we have enough room to put ours on. And that is, you know, we'll hear red flags where a mother might say, you know, our daughter has changed over the years. She's just different than she's used to be. And so that is the ultimate thing. And think about it, you know, when Tiffany and I went to the altar, what was the first thing that Tiffany gave up?
I think it's going to be like last name.
Yeah. It was her last name. Yeah. And so we take that, that's just something we take for granted, but that was a really hard thing for Tiff. And it, you know, she told me, she says, you change your name to Rudiak. I'm not changing my name. You can be Roy Rudiak. I'm not going to be Tiffany Mitten. And that was a really great frame of reference for me, right? Because my last name, boy, that means a lot to me. And as I share this with ladies, what was it like when you gave your last name to him? They all, you can see it in their body language. It was something very special. And it's not a point to say that, you know, they'll also say they were proud to do that. Mm-hmm. But I think, are we recognizing it as men, that sacrifice? Would we be so willing to jump in, or do we feel entitled as men? Because I think that there is a level of entitlement when we don't even recognize that.
Yeah, and I think you see that commonly now, at least a lot of either hyphenated names or people just keep their names. And part of that, yeah, is you know, the lady wants to keep their identity now. And, you know, that probably goes into larger or to other areas of discussing about marriage and kind of the unity that comes with it. But I think you highlighted an important point, is that, yeah, I'll speak for myself. The fact that, you know, my wife gives up her last name and takes mine, it almost seems like it's a clerical issue. You know, it's just a matter of changing your driver's license or something like that. But it's highlighting something significantly than that.
And if I may, when, you know, when Theophilos was born, my last son, Grace was six and she's sitting in the back and we're bringing him home and she's looking at him. And I said, what are you looking at, honey? And she says, you know, when Theophilos gets married, he still gets to be Mitten. But I'm not allowed to be anymore. I have to take my husband's name. 6 years old. And she said, that feels like, that makes me sad. Yeah. And I'm saying to you, it's like, I'm not here to restructure the world, but I think that men, I think there's things, a lot of things that we, what we call piggyback entitlement. And I think the world would be a far different place if we just recognize the sacrifice our wives made. My wife will bleed for 25% of our adult life so that we can have a family. Yet I will probably complain about that. You know,
yeah.
It's awkward to even talk about, but yet it is so staggering, the statistics on period poverty in Canada, the greatest country in the world, and women do not have a right to feminine hygiene. Most women will, when I talk to them about this, most women will, their body language will reveal. And when I say that women will not be able to do things that they want to do because of the lack of feminine hygiene, or, you know, maybe dad in the house wouldn't let them buy the proper feminine hygiene because it was too much money, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, for men to recognize that sacrifice that their wives make, I think is something that we don't even talk about in premarital, but I think is absolutely essential. Like what's my part in that walk? Because my wife takes that off my shoulders every single month. And I'll tell you, if I did it once, I'd probably take the whole week off. Right? Like, I'm just being frank. If I woke up and so, you know, it's those things, I think that they're little things, but they make the world a difference. When we start to look at what is our rights and what is our responsibilities. And if I can just bring the gospel into it. Christ's bride could not do it. on their own.
And just to clarify, that's, you're referring to the church and when you're referring to the Christ bride. In that case.
And so with today.
Our audience is probably all over the place.
We could get on that one. Yeah.
That could be. I don't mind being a little bit of an interpreter here.
Run with that. And so, you know, if we looked at it, you know, it says that he condescended heaven, it came to earth and did everything that he needed for me so that I could be looked at by God equally in sinlessness, right? When Tiffany walked down that aisle, she was adorned in white, and it was not as a reflection of her sex life. That's not the intention. The intention is it's looking towards the day when Christ will come back and we will go to him and we will be wearing white, not because of our purity, but it's a badge of the purity that Christ put on us. And it says for me to love my wife just that way. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loves his church. And I think that is the ultimate duty of what we do as a ministry, is to awaken that in the heart of men. We're recording this. We're not doing it live. And tomorrow is Remembrance Day, or the day after.
Yep.
The day after?
Day after. Yep.
I always think about Vimy Ridge. They talk about the great sacrifice of Vimy Ridge, where men took the hill, Canadian boys. And then on that day, there was not a single family or neighborhood or community in Canada that didn't know somebody that was affected on that hill. And I don't even know what they took that hill for. I don't know what that sacrifice is. They paid the ultimate sacrifice. I mean, there is the heart of a lion inside men that God has placed there that we need to awaken again with great certainty, because it's there for the taking and our families right now need it. And so I think that as we talk about domestic abuse, it's not that men are the problem. It's that men are the solution. It's how can we empower men
to use
their power responsibly, to always use their power to bless and always use their power to empower. Because if my wife is not empowered, then I am not empowered, you know, and this is the ultimate, this is the ultimate message of the gospel, is that Jesus Christ used what we did not have and did everything that needed to be done so that we could benefit from it just the same. And he did not do that because he had to, or he needed to, but because he got to. There was a great blessing in that. And I think that needs to be awakened again. I do not believe that my headship has anything to do with followership. I think that my headship has to do with leadership. And leaders lead. When Jesus died on that cross, there was nobody that thought that was a good idea. But he did it anyway. And what if we could awaken the heart of our church, the men in our church, to do the same, to say, we're going to do the thing that is not just right, but responsible. And we're going to move forward. Because even if we do sometimes, we do the right thing, but we do it the wrong way, it doesn't serve us, right? It says that God judges us by our hearts. Men judge us by what we do. And so when I talk about the what and the why of domestic abuse, I think at the ultimate it is that if I'm doing something that's out of line with what God would want me to do for motive, it's not good enough. And I mean, that means I believe that I could go home. You know, I love Oswald Chambers. And Oswald Chambers says that he didn't abuse because he was too much of a coward. Because he said that it's not what we do, it's why we do it. And that I was just too scared to get called out. So he said that inside, it's not good enough that we don't do something, but that we don't do it for the right reason, right? Because we know how wrong it is, that we take our headship and we always put our families in place before us, empathize with them, relate to them. Think about Jesus Christ when he goes, and his friend has died, and he's going to walk on the scene, and he knows what he's going to do. He's going to raise him from the dead, but he doesn't raise him from the dead. He stops and he cries. He actually stops to fixing the problem to leave them in agony, right? Because the sooner that he's out of that grave, the tears will stop. They'll be turned to tears of joy. But he actually stops and cries. he takes a moment and reflects, right? And values their pain. Doesn't, you know, and then he goes and fixes the problem. First thing he did was he drew them to him by connecting with them. Jesus wept. And then he rose him from the dead. And I didn't grow up in a home like that. You know, I grew up in a home where, you know, it was like your intense emotions were a problem and you needed that to get wrapped up. We are not put on this earth as men to fix problems. We are here to draw our family together so they know that they're not alone and that everything's going to be okay. There's a lot of problems in this world that we are not going to be able to fix that are in the hands of God. He's the fixer of problems. We're supposed to be responsible. That's our response, is to draw our family close so that they know it's going to be okay. We might not have all the answers right away. Nothing in life is ever a quick fix. But that if they know that we relate to them, and that that is the ultimate power that we can do, is you know, and you see this in the Roman soldiers, and they never in the New Testament ever talk bad about the Roman army. The Roman soldier would be led by a man who would stand shoulder to shoulder with them. He would have the same armor as them, the same weapon. He would stand in the front and center in the most dangerous place. He'd be the first one to hit the enemy. So when they were following him, they weren't following him. Like he was setting the example. It says that Jesus went before us to set us an example for us to follow in his footsteps. Right. And it says that when life wasn't fair for Jesus, he didn't fight back. Right. Now that's the concept is that we all say that we'll take a bullet for our wife. But what if she's having a kind of day that she just pulled the trigger, right? Because that's what it says. Peter says about Jesus is that when we pulled the trigger, he didn't fight back. He didn't retaliate. He trusted himself to he who judges justly. And I think that in the heart of a man is very powerful, is that awakening that loving, how do we love our wives like Christ loves his church? It's not an emotion. It's a Romans 5:8 action. So that's respect. You know, that they feel valued. Then we go into accountability is the next one. And that's when we don't minimize, deny, or blame what we do, which is the opposite. What we want to do is we want to take responsibility, not defend ourselves. So we want to understand. And the last one is we want to support her in the things that are important. Now I'm going to draw a quick illustration for you.
Go for it.
You drop a seed in the ground and that's safety. It starts to grow. It'll grow a trunk of the tree. And that is respect. The branches come out and the leaves, and that's what we call accountability. And then the ecosystem, you know, the rain and the sun, that is support. And if that support is in a cycle and stays there in due season, fruit will be born on that tree, and that fruit will be trust. We don't choose to trust. Trust is either there or it's not. It's a byproduct. So we don't work on building trust. We build those four things. And when those four things are there and present, trust is just there. If trust is diminished and betrayed, we go back and we start to plant that seed and we start. So that's the essence of what we're working at, is creating relations with those four things. 69% of conflict that you'll have with your wife, you will not resolve. But yet 95% of what we're working on in marriage counseling is communication, conflict resolution. But the stats show that most marriages, you know, I like hot wings. Tiffany likes honey garlic. We've been together for 17 years and it's not going to change. You know, she likes Hawaiian pizza. I like pepperoni. And I know those are marginal disagreements, but it's like if we can get to a place where both parties feel safe, respected, accountable, supported, then you can disagree about almost anything and you're going to work it through. And you see couples that have been married for 50 years, 60 years. They never read the book, Love Languages or Love and Respect or whatever the books are that are hot topics. These people have those four things. You know, that's what they've worked on, is the fundamentals and, you know, that those were present and they worked through the rest. And am I saying that don't get conflict resolution skills? No, I'm not saying in communication, no, but I'm saying the first thing we want to measure is those four things. Whatever we build a relationship on top of matters. This is not a message for domestic violence. This is for every single relationship. And that, you know, that that we wait until we go into domestic violence intervention before this is mentioned is criminal. That's the criminal, is that we need to get this message out sooner and faster. It's and you know, we can make a difference. We can make a difference. So
yeah, kind of interesting as you tied in at the end there. Last or previous podcast, we were talking about kind of the different aspects of culture, and one of them was beliefs. But there's another aspect of culture which was termed meta beliefs. But really, those are just the kind of foundational ones. And as we kind of noting culture and kind of some of the divisions we're seeing more divisions, I think, at foundational levels. And so you might have, you know, you might be in a relationship where you and your wife agree on the type of pizza, but your foundational issues are really the problem.
Absolutely.
And if those crumble, then all those superficial agreements are lost. So these four things, as you said, the safety, the respect, the accountability, and support, those are critical for all relationships. And when we start seeing abuse, would you say we're seeing something wrong at that root system with one of those four?
Absolutely. And that is the fundamental thing, is that if somebody has those four things, abuse does not exist. You cannot hit somebody or call them a name or control them with money or isolate them, right? The opposite of support is isolation. And so you have to remove one of those four things before you can start to abuse. And so we're looking at the problem, like when the house is on fire. What I want to do is I want to look at the structures in relationships that make it sound, and then we can build on top of that. You know, in the work that I do with men in 30 weeks, we spend 20% of the time, that's it, on resolving differences. We spend the massive amount of time on those four fundamentals over and over and over again. And this is a world that respect is something that it's under attack. You know, respect is just something that is not a given. Safety is not a given. Emotional safety is psychological safety. Accountability, good grief. I mean, I don't even want to get into that. These things that we think that we're promoting, we need them at a fundamental level again. We've lost them. And so this is where I see the issue at and where I work at.
Did you have any questions up to this point? Yeah.
I don't
feel like we're excluded. Okay.
No, just enjoying listening. I think there's a lot of good stuff here. One thing did kind of come to my mind was, would it be fair to say then that like men have a God-given power, but in today's world, it's a very much misdirected power. Yeah. So you kind of want to bring that power back to where it's intended to be.
Well, yeah, just to piggyback on that, because when you're talking about that, like about men being the solution, I think what often, or the kind of the message that I think a lot of men are hearing in culture is that they're toxic. Like that's the catchword, toxic masculinity.
Yep.
The problem is the patriarchy. So the fact that you are a male means you are a problem, and you simply need to step aside now. Yeah. And let, you know, let female come up, or at least some sort of oppressed class come up. Male or the man, he's had his time. He needs to step aside and basically it gives men this impression that they're kind of expendable.
Yeah. And I do agree with that. Are you saying something?
Well, I was just thinking with that. So it's like nowadays it's either you have men with power in a negative way, or men should be weak rather than men should use their power appropriately.
Yeah. And this is a hot topic.
Yeah.
And you know, I want to just, before I start there, I want to go to a reference on the Dove commercials. Were you aware of them? The Dove commercials put out this idea for toxic masculinity, and they put out a commercial about it, and we need to stop raping women and be nicer to women and yada, yada. And I'm not yada, yadaing. I'm just trying to move it along because it's very important. Yes. That is not just a message that I agree with. It is what I've dedicated my life to. Yeah. And But the thing was that Dove had a real hard time selling soap, men's soap at that time. And it wasn't because men stopped buying the soap, because men don't buy the soap. Women buy the soap. And that message, women don't appreciate either. You know,
that men should be kind of
typical.
Kind of
typical women are not relating to that toxic masculinity mm-hmm. message. So do I think that we have an issue with power misused? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But let's set aside gender and let's stay focused on responsible use of power. And this is the way Moses addressed it. And I'd like to go back, you know, he's a pretty fundamental guy. And so he wrote the marriage covenant with this kind of idea was that this is a fallen world. And the deck has been stacked against women for centuries. And if we think that this world is like not that way, then we live in luxury, because if you go to Afghanistan right now, you'll see how fragile women's rights are.
Oh man, like overnight.
Overnight women went from being anchormen and politicians and school teachers and allowed to read and write and go to university to threats of battery acid splashed on them and keep her at home because she won't be safe. Gang raping and the likes. And so Moses did not create the fallen world. But if you read the marriage covenants that he wrote thousands of years ago, it is absolutely staggering that the ideas of empowerment of women that existed in a fallen world where women were not as worth as much as cattle in those days. So, you know, how much more like that we fashioned a world that Moses wanted. Moses' original vision was that women were created in the image of God, no different than us, and that was not supposed to be negotiated because of the fallen world. And if you look back in ancient history, the Hebrews were exclusive in the fact that women could own land, divorce their husbands, and have their own money. Women had so much power, and it wasn't to be limited. It's not like that we said, okay, that's enough now. But somewhere along the Middle Ages, we lost sight. You know, Jesus empowered women too. And toxic masculinity is masculinity that falls into the fallen world. And do I think it's there? I absolutely, because I minister to women. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the ideas of, you know, the statistics do not do justice about like things like sex, you know, women, how they're exploited sexually, just in their marriages alone, we could do a whole evening on the ideas of how we are not handling, you know, sexual respect effectively in our marriages as men, because we don't even talk about it. And so if you don't talk about it to a guy, how in the heck do you expect that he's going to not make mistakes? Right. Mm-hmm. And so it's like Moses made provisions in an ancient world that was awful to women, where, you know, in a Hebrew marriage, you couldn't touch your wife for 12 months, right? You had a sexual responsibility to her to build a relationship before you went to bed with her, right? You know, Joseph did not know her, right? And they didn't have an engagement. You didn't say, honey, would you marry me? It was like, the marriage was made. You're now married and you keep your hands off her for 12 months because that was a responsibility. You didn't just have a God-given right. That, like, think just on that thing alone 2,000 years ago, where the Romans, you know, the Roman Empire, women were like, you could take the life of any woman in your home and they wouldn't even come looking for her. Like, so I don't know how it's gotten backwards, where the perception is that we don't, like, that we look at women as like beneath us, when actually Moses created a world that men would always use their powers so that women, no matter how off kilter this world got, women would always be in the image of God. Mm-hmm. And so that, I think, is, you know, that to me is the essence of it. You know, do I feel that we've misused that? Absolutely. Like, I think that one of the biggest things that we have failed as Christian men is that it was women that had to protect women from men and built the first women's shelters when I was I was born. You know, the women's shelters are only 50 years old, and it was not men that said, we need to protect ladies. Because I'll tell you, like, in the ancient days of the Hebrews, that wouldn't have not gone on down. It just would not have happened. But today, for some reason, we turned our blind eye. Have you ever heard the expression, the rule of thumb? We use that, but do you know what that rule is? It was a British rule that gave you permission to discipline your wife with a stick that was, it couldn't be any wider than your thumb. That was the measurement. So this is like, we use this all the time because it got so corrupted. The ideas we need to have, not a new, sometimes people say, I've got like this new idea of Christianity. I say, no way. This is to set it, to reset the ideas that, it's not acceptable for a man to hurt his wife under any conditions. And it's not about if my wife will let me be a man or not. That's about me. And manhood has nothing to do with masculinity in a toxic or two-dimensional sense. It's the question of Jesus Christ. That is the ultimate role of a man. Will you go and do what needs to get done and put yourself on the line so that others don't have to? That's the ultimate, I think, thing that we need to have as discernment as men. And let other people comment on that. I don't need a single lady on this earth to make me a man. That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard in my life. I'm a man because I'm a man. It's like Jesus, when he came to the earth, how many people did he have an election, like a vote? Did he vote? Did people vote him in? No, he was the savior and he was Messiah. And they could all debate it all they wanted, but he was out. He had an agenda. And the only one that got hurt in that agenda was who? Him. Right. And I said, what would it look like if men were rose and raised up that way? If they were told that one day a young lady will take a terrible chance on you, and then you will largely determine the course of the rest of her life. Because when women divorce, and that's the 80% number I alluded to, you guys, 80% of divorces in the church, 80% are filed by the wife. Yet she is going to, her life will suffer immeasurably compared to her husband. So the idea of a frivolous divorce does not exist. And I work with 9 women for every one man that I work with. And these women do not want divorce. They will do anything. They have suffered for decades, some of them, in the most horrific, inhuman treatment, trying to make it work. And it's like we need to go back and look at Moses. Moses, divorce was not something that women did. It was something that men did. And there was only one reason for it, and that was the hardness of a man's heart. Moses allowed divorce for the hardness of a man's heart. And I think that is the evidence of what's going on right now. Is we have the God-given privilege that he has asked us to come along side by side and to disciple men so that they can have soft hearts for their families. And I say that the day we get started on that is the day the divorce rate starts to plummet. Mm-hmm. Because it's not that we just allow divorce to happen. If you would sit with me for just a week and listen to the depth of suffering that a woman will go through before she finally files for divorce, it will clearly see that the answer lies that it's a leadership problem that we have. And like Moses said, that he allowed divorce for the hardness of a man's heart. And it's not that men, like I said, are the problem. We are the solution.
I think, again, you're highlighting the fact that when the term like toxic masculinity is brought up, it gives the perception that it's masculinity itself that's toxic, and so you just throw it all out. But I think what you would want to what you would say is, yes, there is a form of masculinity that is toxic, but there's also a form of masculinity that God has appointed man to be.
Yeah,
When that happens, when a man can provide a safe, respectful, accountable home that supports his wife, you're going to have a healthy relationship. So it's not when the man is either absent that things get fixed. It's going to be when a man steps up and is the man, the leader that God has appointed him to be.
Absolutely. And that is like not me throwing my weight around in my house.
Yeah.
Tiffany, and I, leadership has nothing to do with followership. I am not measured by if Tiffany's, you know, following me around. If I go down to the Kohl's bookstore right now, I'll find a whole section on leadership. But find me a book on followership. You know, I'm a certified life coach, flourishing life coach, and we just published our new leadership publication. It's over 200-page workbook, 300-page, sorry, fantastic curriculum. Not one page in that 300 pages has anything to do with followership.
Getting people to follow you is what you mean by that.
No, the responsibility of when we have a typical situation where there's abuse, it will be introduced where they'll go to the pastor, and then the idea of submission comes up. But the statistics show that the more you submit to a power and control problem, the more power and control they're entitled to.
So when you're talking about followership, you're talking about the idea that a woman should be a follower, submit to her husband, whatever, wherever he's leading. It's her responsibility just to go along with it.
Right.
Is that right?
Yeah. Okay. And I don't, I just want to make sure. Yeah, I don't agree with, and I just don't agree with that at all. I don't, correct. Because I'll tell you right now, just in a 2021 perspective, I get up tomorrow and I go left and Jesus is going right. He's not going to drag me by my ear. You know, I have free agency. So why on earth does a perfect savior, my perfect husband, let me as the bride, I can go about like and go out of whack. But yet Tiffany, if she does, then we're going to throw down the hammer. Cause I'm an imperfect husband. He's my perfect husband. Yeah. And so I think that ultimately, and I don't get invited to a lot of men's breakfasts to speak because of this message, but I think that ultimately, if I was going to sum it up, you know, with authentic manhood, is that I can't be the husband and father that God created me to be until I'm first the bride of Christ. What is it like to be with a perfect husband? And then before I get to go in and start, you know, because my expectations then are a lot different for Tiffany when I'm walking with her, recognizing that, you know, that I'm walking and that I'm using my headship to prepare for her. We had a Bible scholar look at the things that we teach. Cause I like to scrutinize our work. I like to have, second opinions and peer review. And he looked at it and we were looking at a particular verse, Genesis 3:16b.
I think we've talked on this.
We have, and he came with a totally different angle, right? Because the question was, is it that, you know, women want to control their husbands and men will control them? Or is it that women will have a desire for their husband and he will order? And he said to me, you know, Rory goes, that's a really, like, that was a good one that you presented to me. And he said, I found something and I never saw it before. If you go into the Hebrew, Moses uses the exact same phrase in Hebrew to describe the son's relationship when he created the son to the earth. Now he said, I want you to think about that for a minute. When the son rules over the earth, what does it do? What does it do? Like, you know, it provides growth, you know, the ability to grow. It illuminates it. Right? The Bible constantly talks about how light is safety. We build walls in our cities to protect us from the night. But it doesn't go around bossing around the earth. It doesn't tell it to get up in the morning or go to bed or plant seeds now or anything like that. It just provides the blocks of life, the life-giving things it needs, right? So that's, I believe, ultimately. And that's like right there. And that's controversial. I do think that, I mean, he was certainly convinced of it. And I tend to agree with him that why would Moses use two chapters later, the exact same phrase, rule over, if he's not relating it back to this idea where the son has this immense power in a marriage. And this was after the fall, right? The fallen world. So whether or not we agree on, you know, that application of the Bible, because I'll tell you, that's a tough verse that we can all be divided on. And the people that are listening here, they might all go and get their two cents in. But I want to just put that to the thought of the mind of, if we do look at the relationship between the sun and the earth from a thousands of years ago perspective, we see a much different rule. There's a responsibility the sun has to the earth. There is an immense amount of giving. The earth has no obligation to the sun. It doesn't, you know, and that's what we see in the marriage covenant. We do not see a wife is responsible for this, this, and this. It's because she's at the disadvantage. Think about this. Wives are to submit to their husbands. Think about that 2,000 years ago. Did Paul need to write that?
Like, not in that culture.
right. Yeah. Exactly. So, yeah. So it's opening the eyes to something greater. I truly believe because women, you know, women didn't have any rights. They didn't have any rights. And so, and here we have this Hebrew culture that came out of the desert that was distinctly different in many, many ways. And one of them was, is the way they were with women. Go out and find me other ancient writings that have main characters that are women. Go out and find me heroes of stories that are women. Go out and find me, you know, where women are held in such esteem, you know, where the witnesses to the greatest event in human history, that nothing else matters on this earth if it did not occur, that was witnessed by women, but yet women weren't allowed to testify in those days, right? these things lend towards this idea of my empowerment as a man is to make sure that Tiffany is always empowered in anything that there's a disadvantage, and she is not inferior to me in any way. So these are the ideas that we're very passionate about. And if I may, we didn't get to the thing that usually people start with me on. Is that this didn't come because I, you know, sing in the choir, and this didn't become, you know, I never became a believer until I was 33 years old. You know, Tiffany, I met Tiffany and she was a believer from a Billy, I always want to say Billy Joel, Billy Graham, different rock star, Crusades, but I met Tiffany and, you know, I had a history of violence. I grew up in a home where, you know, my father wasn't, he had cerebral palsy, so physically he could not be dominant, but he didn't need to be. He was horrific to mom and I. I don't have too many men in my family, male figures that I could relate to that did not do terrible things to their wives. It was something that was just around me and it was never used. See, that's one of the biggest struggles with domestic abuse. Is that word was never used. Domestic violence, domestic abuse. We don't recognize it for what it is until it's way out of hand. So if you say, I don't feel safe, I feel intimidated by my husband, and we go that, and the pastor says, that's a problem, right? We see this intimidation. We go, this is an issue. We're gonna get something. But if we wait for someone to get slapped, we're way out of it. And the fact is that most women that get slapped will not report it. They'll protect their husband. So what happened was by the time my wife met me when I was 33, I had already destroyed a family. I had terribly abused my first wife. I had two children that called another man father. And I promised myself when I met Tiffany, I would not do this to her. And when I picked myself up off the floor, the first time I assaulted her, I knew that I had done everything I could do. I tried all the self-help, all of the, you know, the medications, all of the, you know, the sob stories of, it's not your fault because your dad abused you. You don't know better. One of the greatest relationship myths out there. Everybody get your pen and write this down in big bold letters is that hurt people do not hurt people. Selfish people hurt people. And I called the women's shelter. We lived in Calgary at the time. I called the women's shelter and I asked them, do you help men like me? And they said that if I went down, they'd help me. And that program was meant for men who were arrested for criminal domestic violence and charged and had a probation officer. And I volunteered myself into that system. They did not know what to do with me, really. It was a foreign experience. And I went through that program and then we moved to Red Deer. I came here and Jim Freeman, who just recently retired, who patented, like he is like the most groundbreaking man in Canada for domestic violence intervention. And Jim Freeman, let alone I'd say probably in the world, he's one of the most crucial names and here he was right in Red Deer. And so I went and I got help with him. And when I finally got kicked out of the program, because I didn't have a probation officer and they needed the seat, they had graciously given me this time. I just knew that the things I had learned there, there was two problems that I had. The first one was that nobody was talking about this stuff. And it wasn't the stuff about don't slap your wife. It was like the stuff that you, it's not the void of that that creates safety. Right? It's not the void of intimidation that creates safety. It's the actions of safety. But we don't talk about that. And I knew I needed that. And then the second phase to that was that there was such a horrible stigma. You know, when I went into the system, volunteered in there, there was three things I could be called. I was a perpetrator, a batterer, or an abuser. And those things do not liberate you. They limit you by your labels. And labeling never will ever fix a problem. It just, it brings it in. So I went and, when I was done there, I found Christ. And, as I was reading scriptures, I started to find in scriptures the very things I was learning at the shelter. But I knew that there was a vast difference between what the church understood and what they were willing to understand and what was happening. So, I felt a calling on my life, and I, you know, the first, 13 years we've been, yeah, about 13, 14 years ago, Tiff and I stood up in front of 1,000 people at 9 and another 1,000 at 11, and we aired our dirty laundry and we opened up the doors for what we do. Cause I felt that the message had to come out. It's never easy for me to talk about this, but every single thing that I share is not because of the papers that I carry on the wall. It's from the actual heart of a hard man. And nobody is for men more than me because I'm one of them. And you know, I never ever figured in a million years that I would spend 90% of my day with women who have been hurt by men, and that they would actually give me a chance to minister to them. But they find it very validating that how frank I am and how straightforward. And I don't take their trust lightly. And Tiffany and I, you know, I wish she was here tonight, because any guy could come up here and say, I'm all better now. And that's not for me to say, but I will say this is that this ministry is by Tiffany's testimony alone, not my own. But I guess it's important for people to know that until we start having better conversations about this and at a preventative model, until we start recognizing the realities that not the ideal, but the real, right? Not the ideals of relationships and the ideals of power, but the real. What happens when a husband and wife get in gridlock and they're both thinking about their rights? Who gives? And I'll tell you who gives: the person with the advantage. That's what Jesus taught me, and that's what I will do. And I will do it 10 times out of 10, and I will never apologize for it. And it's irrelevant if Tiffany submits to that or not, because I'm going to do it. And that, I think, is, you know, there's toxic masculinity where men throw their weight around. But the one that I'm concerned about is where men are spineless, thinking that they need women to listen to them for them to be men. And I think that is the one that's killing us today, is that, yes, I mean, we're supposed to be in the world, not of the world. And yes, there are challenges in manhood today. Authentic manhood is under siege, but that does not mean that I need like the outside world to vote for me so that I lead. It's that we become men and that we hold ourselves accountable to our actions, not by, you know, our own, but by the people that we're leading. And when they have a problem, we don't defend ourselves. We empathize with them. We make sure that we don't extinguish their identity. We protect it. And that we make sure at all costs that they feel safe. Yeah. And if we can do that, then there's nothing in the world that can stop us from doing that. Right. There's just, because that's things that we can do. And I went into a house the other day where the most horrific acts of violence were being had, like just horrific. I sat with the guy and I'm trying to reason with him, and he's telling me all about her and why she, you know, she's burnt, she's, you know, bruised. And I said, look, you know, we can talk about her all you want, but the bottom line is that we make decisions on what we do as men, and we're the only ones that we can control. Right. And he turned his head and he said, you're right. You know, for what it's worth, I mean, there's a long way to go on that story, but my point is that personal agency we have. Personal agency we choose. And when I guarantee nobody thought it was a good idea that Jesus went to the cross that day. That was a very shameful thing. Very shameful thing that he did that day. They were not happy about that, but he did it. Not because, you know, and he didn't wait for them to approve of it. He just did it. And when he comes back and they fail him greatly, right? You want to talk about submission and leadership. How did Jesus respond when they didn't listen to him? When they all bailed on him and they cussed him out and he shows up and he just says, let's just get going on with business, right? And those men who betrayed him, he said, stay with me, and they all bailed. But I'll tell you right now, every one of those men paid with their lives to follow him to the very ends of the earth. And I believe that my salvation came from somebody speaking to me that heard it from someone who heard it from those men. It was those men who said that they were going to follow Jesus to the ends of the earth. And I don't know if it would have been like that if he freaked out on them because they didn't listen to him. He awakened that in their hearts, right? He inspired them. I think that leadership comes down to three things in manhood, and that's to inspire the people that you're responsible for, to impact their lives, because their lives are better that you're there. So inspire, impact, and then the last one is influence. I'm not here to tell people what to do. I'm here to influence them by what I do. You know, I believe that that in its essence is all that's needed. Now, I'll tell you, I did the other for, you know, the first half of my life. I did the other way. But I'll tell you right now, when I go to bed tonight, I have a peace in my heart that transcends anything that about what I get by doing that. And that I create a place for my wife that is safe. And if she has the get to say on that, not me. That is the ultimate to me of authentic manhood, healthy manhood. And I think that if we focus on that toxic masculinity, where can it live? That's, and so I think that, that this is such a relevant topic today, that in that, you know, that, the purple lights that we shine and we talk about domestic abuse, it's all tied into this idea that if we can identify that a relationship isn't emotionally safe, it's not psychologically safe, we are going to see then that things are going to change rapidly. We got to look at the more fundamental, not the why, not the what, but the why, and that will change everything. I think too often when we read books about domestic abuse, it's focused on physical acts of force. But most of the women that I minister to, actually, I don't know a single one. If I can give you one real life example, her husband choked her in front of her daughter. And the police were called. Matter of fact, actually, I think this one was even in Pinoca. And the police were called. And when I was talking to her, she became quite a significant influence in our ministry. She really enriched our ministry. She gave deeply to it because of her testimony. But I was talking one time and I said, yeah, and you called the police when he choked you. We were talking and she interrupted me and she said, I didn't call the police when he choked me. I called the police because he took my phone. Because at that point, she knew she was trapped and she was going to be isolated. And that was the real threat. See, that was her identity. She was like, he can't take me. He can slap me or hurt me, but he can't take me. And so it's like there's the physical acts of force have a clear and present danger. They do. And they're to be taken seriously. I'm not saying they don't. However, you know, Tiffany would be here today. She would tell you that when I put my hands on her, that never haunted her the way it did the things I said and the way I isolated her. Those wounds that we cannot see, those were the things that echoed in her. Those were the things that rewrote her identity. Those are the things that, you know, that we create safety, respect, support, and accountability. Those are the things that we can push to the side, and we could make a significant impact as the body of Christ if we could get this. So,
Roy, I and this has been just a great conversation. Thank you for sharing so much of your expertise born out of personal experience. Let me finish on this question. You serve in a ministry in which you see so much suffering and hurt. What gives you, or what, and how do you remain hopeful through all this pain and suffering that you see encountered? Like what we're talking about, the average person just does not visually see if they hear about it all. You know, we might hear the random news report here or there, but you are on the scene. You are seeing the bruises. You are seeing the abuse on the front lines. What gives you hope in to continue on this kind of ministry?
That's a great question. I think the first is that we have to be careful not to take in the guise of giving. And so, you know, there's always a hope. There'll be a day that there will be no more tears. I mean, that is inevitable. And he didn't tell me to measure the success of that and the failure. He told me just to go out and affect people's lives. And not, you know, and so if there's one home before he comes back to free us all, if there's one home that behind closed doors is living a masquerade in the name of Christ, it's not going to be enough for me. I just do. It's not for the measure of effectiveness in the fact that it's the fact that he's asked me to. I truly believe that God asked me to do this. Cause God, I tell you, I did not, this is not how I want to plan my life, was talking about this kind of stigma. And I don't know, you know, it's like, so how do I, you know, how do I keep hope? I hope cause he promises that day is going to come when there's no more suffering and we move forward. And, you know, you cannot abuse who you do not confuse. You know, if I was going to say, what do? We extinguish confusion in relationships. And how do you know when two people come to the table and you see there's troubles is that the one that's confused is the one that's being abused. The one, when you sat me down, I would tell you everything that was wrong with Tiffany, right? I wasn't confused. it was her and I was just defending myself. And yeah, what I did was wrong, but, you know, rah, 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 rah. And so when you sit down with a lady and she feels like she says to like the lady that said to me 2 weeks ago, you've talked to me for 10 minutes and it's like, you've got a camera in my house and she feels understood for the first time. Or when you talk to a guy who's so broken down because he knows deep down inside that is not winning the fight because the fight's been won 2000 years ago. We're asking the wrong questions. We should be standing for our marriages, not fighting. And I ask him, what's your takeaway? And he says, I feel hope again. I haven't felt hope in so long. You know, why do I have hope? Because Jesus is hope and he is the way and the truth and light. I'm not special. I am just one guy who did one thing. And that was said to Jesus that I don't care if you give me $1 million, like the televangelist promised. I don't care if you make me healthy and live long. I don't care. Everlasting life didn't even really matter to me either. The one thing that I held him on was that I didn't get to be the bad guy anymore. That's what he promised me, was that he would free me from that old man. It says that in Christ, you are a new creation. The old is gone and the new is here. And when men feel that they're understood by somebody who's been there and done it and they're not being judged, and that it's that freedom that Christ had. That must have been what Matthew felt like when he was a tax collector and, you know, taking advantage of his fellow people. You know, it must have been how Paul felt. I think Paul has been the greatest model in my life of a man who persecuted Christ's bride. They must have felt that same hope, you know, when they came to terms with who they were in their sinful nature. So that's how I feel. I feel, honestly, I would feel hopeless if I did not answer his call.
Thank you so much for giving up your time, for your words of wisdom. I hope what we've gone over today, I hope you see how applicable this is, not just to look, find the problem out there, we easily look at the issues other people are having. But I think you've provided so many great tips and insights to how we can evaluate our own marriage, to take a realistic look at the, if you will, the culture in our own homes. What kind of relationship are we building? What direction is that relationship going on? And perhaps if we need to put some brakes on some bad habits that may be leading us in the wrong way. So thank you so much.
You're welcome.
For coming on.
I would like to say always have one more thing. I talked tonight and I don't know if it'll get picked up in the tone, but I have acknowledged that, we can't fix the problem. We don't acknowledge it. And in the church, I want to say though that, Tiffany and I believe that we needed to make an impact in Christ's body in central Alberta before we start talking to the world and before we start to talk about the outside. And when I am connected in other parts of the world, in North America, with the plight of domestic violence in the church, it's not the same in central Alberta. And we've been on the scene for 13 years. And, if a woman comes to their pastor, there are a lot of churches in this community that know what we do, and they're able to recognize that something's not quite right, and they refer them towards us, not because they're against the men, because they're for them. And I want to say that we have, if there's pastors that hear this message tonight, there's more work that does need to be done, but we can't do it without you guys. And more can be done. We have a workshop coming up at the end of the month. If you go on yourthrivingfamily.com or check us out on social media, you would be able to see that. And it's the beginning and the basics of understanding. It's called Faith, Family, and Violence. And it's to understand the impact that we can make and the hope that we can bring, because anybody can talk about hope in correcting bad behavior, but there's nobody that's in the business except Jesus Christ of saying that the old is gone and the new is here. Nobody else can say that. We have the exclusivity on that, the copyright. And I'll tell you, when you come to terms with not what you've done, but why you've done it, you just don't forgive yourself. It's not humanly possible. That takes the Son of Man to come down. That's what takes that in Christ, you are a new creation. The old is gone, new is here. Because the self-hatred, the self-punishment will consume you. That's why you minimize, deny, and blame. Because if you truly take responsibility for what you do, it'll eat you alive. And that is something that only Jesus provides. That's the only thing that nobody else can say, that he doesn't wash your sins clean. He makes you as if you were never, ever dirty.
I couldn't agree more. The weight of our sin is just something that the world and ourselves cannot handle. That will be a weight that only one person can and has taken away from all of us, if we so decide. Thank you for again joining us, Roy Mitten. You need to check out yourthrivingfamily.ca. There are resources, there are classes, in the multiples. There are so many different avenues and angles that you take when it comes to healthy and thriving relationships that anyone, no matter where you are in your relationship, check it out. You will probably find something here that can help improve where you are and where you can start heading. So thank you again for your time. My name is Brian Constein.
And I'm Michael Rowland.
And this has been Penhold Talk Radio.